This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, September 2nd, 2012, the first edition of Ozarks in September. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, begins its 2012-2013 season Sunday, September 16th at 3 p.m. at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. The opening concert will include Wagner's Tannhäuser Overture, Barber's Violin Concerto featuring soloist Winona Feifeld, Brahms Symphony No. 2. Tickets available by calling 443-5600 or visit sonamusic.org.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a familiar restaurant chain celebrates its birthday and a review of area infrastructure changes.
But first, the price of natural gas has tanked in recent years due to a surplus generated by thousands of new shale gas production wells across the country, including in north central Arkansas. Now, with proposed liquefied natural gas export facilities in the works, Arkansas stands to profit once again. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, not everyone is on board.
The United States has long been an importer of methane, commonly referred to as natural gas. But unconventional mining techniques to extract methane from shale basins in the Northeast, Mid-South, and West have resulted in a motherload of methane reserves. The Arkoma Formation in western Arkansas has been a conventional producer of methane for years. But in 2004, a new drilling technique, which uses water, sand, and lubricating chemicals to bore through and crack horizontal gas-rich shale deep underground in north central Arkansas, opened up the so-called Fayetteville Shale Preserves beneath Claiborne, Conway, Faulkner, Searcy, and White counties. More than 4,000 wells have been drilled, creating nearly 10,000 jobs and yielding $59 million in severance tax revenues. That's just last year. Investment in exploration and production by industry totaled $12.7 billion between 2008 and 2011. But due to a national glut of gas, production has slowed dramatically. That's because natural gas is selling for around $2 per 1,000 cubic feet, compared to $3 last December and nearly $11 in July of 2008 when the shale gas boom started to peak. That's the so-called wellhead price. As a consequence, gas companies like Houston-based Southwestern and subsidiaries have been reporting losses, so are shutting down operations and laying off workers. Because of the surplus, certain members of Congress are pushing to export liquefied natural gas, or methane, that's been purified, concentrated, and chilled for storage and shipping. On August 7th, a bipartisan group of 44 congressmen from Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Arkansas submitted a letter to U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu requesting he speed up approval of liquefied natural gas exports. Among them was U.S. Representative Rick Crawford, Republican District 1. District 3 Representative Steve Womack was away attending the Republican National Convention in Florida at press time, and outgoing Democratic Congressman Mike Ross from District 4, who declined comment. But Arkansas Congressman Tim Griffin, whose district lies in the heart of frack country, did agree to comment via email. He said it is critical to find new markets for Arkansas-produced energy, so seeks to expedite the approval process for the export of liquefied natural gas. Griffin is referring to the U.S. Department of Energy, which is currently researching the macroeconomic impacts of proposed U.S. natural gas exports on the U.S. economy. The study will help the department in reviewing pending applications, but legislators would like the Department of Energy to set up a firm timeline now. Increased liquefied natural gas production will likely boost the production of compressed natural gas, or CNG, fuel supplies nationwide. But Uvalde Lindsay, Democratic State Representative for District 88, Fayetteville, and part of Washington County, has strong reservations about exporting valuable Arkansas resources overseas.
If we export Arkansas's natural gas, you know, a finite resource, obviously, that sooner or later the Fayetteville Shale will be depleted, and we sell it to foreign countries, it seems we sort of deprive ourselves of that valuable resource. So I've got to try to balance in my mind the need to increase the consumption of natural gas as opposed to some other sources of energy. And CNG for domestic consumption, automobiles and trucks and that sort of thing makes good sense to me, I think, because you're benefiting, you're building America as a fossil fuel alternative, if you will. And now I think that helps us directly by building the domestic fuel supply as opposed to trading in liquid natural gas in the export market. Keep in mind, too, that there is a lot of gas all over the world, and there are a lot of, particularly in the Middle East, and there are a lot of liquid natural gas, LNG facilities being built in the Middle East. I'm afraid that we may be butting into or getting into a market that may be difficult for us to compete in long term.
In 2011, the U.S. Department of Energy estimated the Fayetteville Shale Formation held as much as 32 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Nationwide, the Energy Information Administration estimated we had 827 trillion cubic feet of gas. But earlier this year, it cut that figure by 40%. Plus, the Department of Energy says that estimating the technically recoverable natural gas, that's the stuff that they can get out of the ground in the United States, is an evolving process. Again, Arkansas State Representative Uvalde Lindsay.
And I think we need to be very, very careful about where we go with this and make sure that we have a holistic, if you will, a wide-ranging alternative energy package that that our nation looks at every particular alternative energy source, whether it's wind or solar or anything else, in relation to the mix and the cost and how we could benefit the energy markets and the energy system within the domestic economy, within America, to take care of Americans.
From 2008 until 2011, more than $1.2 billion of mineral leases and royalty payments were issued by gas companies to owners across the state. Because of the gas glut, though, mineral leaseholders have also seen their income decline this year. Kelly Robbins is director of Arkansas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners. In an email for this story, he stated that expanding markets for harvested natural gas is a logical next business step. The U.S. Energy Information Agency predicts that by 2016, our natural gas supply could exceed demand. In mid-2006, we had 5 operating liquefied natural gas import terminals in North America, and the U.S. was poised to construct at least 4 dozen more. Today, we have 1 natural gas liquefaction export facility in Alaska, a new one authorized in Louisiana along the Gulf Coast, and another planned on the Chesapeake Bay off the Marcellus Shale play, which will surely meet resistance. Among those in opposition stand the Sierra Club. It says building and operating a massive new liquefied gas export infrastructure, including thousands of miles of pipeline, will inevitably place communities at risk for increased air and water pollution. Plus, it says, the U.S. State Department needs to carefully assess if exporting gas to places like China serve the public interest. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The transition from summer to fall is made apparent by the quail of songbirds. Recordist and essayist Joe Neal illustrates.
The poet Walt Whitman called his masterwork Leaves of Grass. I've been thinking about grass, too. So are Dick Sissels, who lived there. This is the voice of hay fields, pastures, land of horizon, cows, and barbed wire fence. Summer has sun of fire and furnaces of heat. It has big cumulus clouds marching caravan-like across open sky. You recall this place, don't you? When you were a child and went out there to find a meadowlark's eggs buried in grass? Saw the bluebird build its nest in a wooden fence post? A big hawk, bright sun shining through red tail, soars overhead, held in the sky by little more than rising heat. The small bird there, yellow and red with a large gray bill, singing on the power line, is a dick thistle. They sport a black vest like meadow larks. The following recording is dominated by a dick thistle, but there are many other birds singing, plus a busy highway out beyond the fields. Dick thistles don't live here all year. They winter in Central and Northern South America, where they are plain brown. As spring comes to North America, plain brown turns all handsome reds, yellows, and grays. That's how they look by late April, when the first few birds suddenly appear in Arkansas. Unfortunately, dick thistles stake out nesting territory in hay fields, and those nests get baled up, along with the rest of the tall grass. So they try again. June, July, and August is best. Dick thistle songs belong to high summer. Because of the late nests, I see some dick thistles feeding fledglings into late September. Most of the birds are gone by then, headed south. Fall has come, and while we still have grass, October has few dick thistles. Mostly we hear chip notes like those in the following recording. Big grasslands now seem empty, but we'll look for them next year out in the leaves of grass.
Joe Neal is co-author of Arkansas Birds, published by the University of Arkansas Press. His latest book, In the Province of Birds, a Western Arkansas Memoir, is published by Half Acre Press.
You have probably no doubt noticed many spots of construction and repair on area streets and sidewalks. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis took a closer look at those taking place around Fayetteville. Here's his report.
Infrastructure. We walk on it, drink from it, and use it to bring light to darkness in our everyday lives. We've talked about infrastructure a few times in the past week here on Ozarks. As anyone who has been in downtown Fayetteville this past week can probably attest, city crews are busy with repair work at different points on Dixon Street. Keith Shreve is with the city's transportation department.
Watch for the workers on Dixon Street. We know it's a heavily traveled street. But we're trying to minimize the traffic interruptions and get people in and out the best we can. But the crew will be there in the street, so we just ask that the motorists watch out for them.
The work crews are replacing three crosswalks on the street to make for smoother travel.
Well, we're getting some deterioration in the bricks and the concrete that holds the brick in place. They're becoming trip hazard for the pedestrians and just rough to drive over if you were in a car. They were just getting in poor condition, and we needed to make some repairs.
The eastbound lane was closed to traffic over the past week as the crews worked to rebuild the three crosswalks between Gregg and University Avenue. But Dixon was not the only street getting attention last week. At its meeting Tuesday night, the City Streets Committee came up with a plan to replace sidewalks along a half block of Center Street near College Avenue. Jeremy Pate is the city's director of development services.
On the north side of Center Street, the sidewalks will essentially be constructed back in their same width. There won't be any widening necessarily, so they'll be about between 8 and 9 feet wide. Again, they'll still have the brick band and street trees and street lights, but it'll be the same sidewalk width. On the south side, however, there will be two or three bump outs, or basically areas where the sidewalk widens out. That will allow for several things. Primarily, it will allow for additional pedestrian capacity. That side of the street has most of the pedestrian activity anyway, with all the restaurants on that side of the street.
The bump outs will give room to allow for more benches, bike racks, and sidewalk cafe-style restaurants, provided business owners obtain the appropriate permits. Though the wider area would benefit restaurants that are currently on the south side of the street, Pate says that planning infrastructure development requires thinking in a longer term.
Obviously, when we build streets and sidewalks, though, they may be there for the next 50, 60 years. In a lot of the cases, that's what we're replacing, are 50, 60, 80-year-old sidewalks. So to say that, you know, the use there is always going to be the same use, it's always going to be law offices on the north side, I don't necessarily think that's the case. 50 years ago, it probably wasn't the case. There are some empty buildings on the north side, and there's a movement by some people that live and work in that area to try to invigorate the north side just as successfully as the south side has been. So to add restaurant space or add other spaces within that area.
And just because only the south side of the street is being redesigned doesn't mean that the north side will be forever static.
You know, if this is successful, we can come back and revisit that. We're not changing the travel lanes, you know, where the streets, where people drive, those are staying the same width, so deliveries and all that won't be affected. Essentially, what's being affected is how many parking spaces are out there to be utilized for those businesses.
While the design that would have expanded both sidewalks on the street would have costed $20,000 more than the original design, Pate says that the new design with bump outs on only one side of the street would cost less than the first alternative. Aside from sidewalks, the committee also decided to build a tunnel beneath Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The tunnel will connect the city's Frisco Trail to a southern extension that will stretch all the way to Walker Park. The tunnel was one of three options considered for crossing the highway. Alternatives to the tunnel were an at-grade crossing with a full-size traffic signal, similar to the trail crossing at North Street, or the construction of a 20-foot-tall bridge across the five lanes. Though there are a handful of tunnels on the city's trails, Pate says that this new tunnel will be similar to the newest tunnel that takes cyclists and pedestrians beneath Garland Avenue.
The other tunnels that we've used thus far have all been retrofits. They've basically been drainage tunnels that we retrofitted in order to allow for pedestrian activity. It still means water will flow through them, though, you know, during high events. So if we get all this rain projected to come our way, likely those tunnels will be inundated with water. The ones that are for pedestrian use, though, like Garland and MLK, we actually design and install pumps in those so that any water that gets in them from basically just the sidewalk or the trail leading into it drains automatically to a basin and it's pumped right out. So it works much better than retrofitting a drainage tunnel.
Though no construction contracts have been made, Pate says that construction should start in the spring and take between 9 and 12 months to finish. And sidewalks and tunnels aren't the only infrastructure projects underway in Northwest Arkansas. Work continues on adding lanes to Interstate 540, on moving utilities to widen highways 265, 16, and 112, and even on rural water projects in South Washington County, just to name a few examples. And the Fayetteville area isn't alone in its push to develop infrastructure. Jane Hughes is the City of Fort Smith's Downtown Development Director.
In October of last year, we took to the board and asked for infrastructure with water and sewer lines going in along Riverfront Drive. And we were awarded that request, and so they have started construction on that. So we've got dirt moving down there, and that's fantastic.
The water and sewer improvements are just a part of a larger plan to rejuvenate the riverfront and general downtown area. The wish list for redeveloping the area includes moving a train engine repair yard that has marked the riverfront for years. And the owner of the rail yard said last week that they would consider moving the yard. In addition, part of a downtown truck route would be moved.
We have phased the project into three phases. The first one, of course, being relocating the rail yard itself. After that would happen, we would hope that we could close a portion of North A, which is just to the south of North B, and create a beautiful green space, more like a promenade and an entryway into our riverfront for these people coming down for events or for those people that are coming in from 540, taking the Grand Avenue exit and coming into downtown to go to the new Marshall's Museum, which they'll start ground here in a few years. Or the goal is new corporate headquarters for employment on the riverfront.
With overall growth in the area, residents will eventually have to deal with infrastructure development in one form or another. Just remember, without infrastructure, there would be no streets to drive on, no trails to walk, and no pipes to bring us water. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
The coming week is National Waffle Week, and Waffle House will celebrate its 57th birthday. To kick off the festivities, I took a field trip to the Waffle House on Dixon Street in Fayetteville, where hash browns were sizzling on the flat-top grill. Nick Williams is the division manager for the area. He oversees 7 stores in Missouri and 8 in Arkansas, this Dixon Street location being one of them.
This is an unusual circumstance because we're in the bottom story of a condominium on Dixon Street. We had to work with the space that we were provided. And actually, after this store was built like this, there's been numerous stores across the country built close to campuses in situations like this. And this was kind of a learning experience for everybody. But, you know, I think we did pretty good with 28 seats squeezing in this little area, along with the rest of the kitchen and everything else that we need to operate.
Traditional Waffle Houses are freestanding, small buildings, and typically seat 33 to 43 people. The layout here is a bit different. The kitchen is wider than most, and rather than walking straight into the back room, grill operators and salespeople must hook a left to enter. The seating appears to be normal, the traditional booths and sit-up bar that customers are used to. But if you look to the walls, you'll find the decor is different. The tile trim lining the ceiling has character. 2 of them, actually. An Arkansas Razorback chasing, yep, a waffle with feet. This is also the logo that location employees wear on their uniforms, reminding customers that this is a college town and the University of Arkansas is right up the street. The Waffle House Company is very involved with local communities. Location manager Roy Odema says this spot in downtown Fayetteville is a prime place to do just that.
We like to do things with the university. We'll do discounts for the students and all that. We like to make it fun for them on game days. Sometimes we'll have Saturday nights, we'll have the president of the company out here playing bag-o at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, it's something that's unique that a lot of other Waffle Houses don't necessarily get that opportunity, but it's a good community-wise, it fits what Waffle House stands for. You want to be involved, and we've done some other things that, some charity work as well, but not necessarily for press, just because that's what Waffle House does, so.
He mentioned game days, and yesterday was the first game of the football season in Reynolds Razorback Stadium. As one can imagine, game days are often this location's busiest time, falling second only to Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue, where they see over a 30% increase in sales. On a given shift, the 29-seat restaurant will turn about 7 to 8 times. Manager Roy says that preparation is key.
We're excited about it. We try to staff up for those nights, make sure we have extra hands. Also, another thing that's important is, we have to be very, a step ahead as far as the scheduling on Dixon Street, as far as what's going on the street. If there's a concert or something like that, we want to be prepared for those nights as well.
During busy shifts, it's all hands on deck, or grill. Roy mentioned earlier that the president of the company, who lives in Little Rock, is present on game day. But he isn't there just playing bag-o. He also cooks on the line. Another unique feature of the company as a whole, managers cook too. While I was there, one of the district managers donned a yellow and black striped hat, stepping in to help with the lunch shift, as Roy was busy talking with me. Atypical to this location are the times of day they see the most customers, as Nick Williams points out.
This store is unusual because the street, there's not much activity on the street during the day, but at night, we just kind of blow up. 11 to 4, 11 to 5, we just get busy. And most of the other stores that actually have parking and have other businesses around them open in the morning, they all have a busy first shift as well in the morning.
They say that the best sellers also make this store unusual, the most ordered item being the cheeseburger. Kelly Thrasher with communications at the Waffle House headquarters in Norcross, Georgia, says that breakfast items are the most popular nationwide.
I think our actual best seller is actually coffee. And then waffles are absolutely up there.
They estimate that they sell 144 waffles per store per day.
So when you do that on a daily basis for each location, it totals about 85 million. So that's a lot of waffles.
Those sizzling hash browns are also very popular. Waffle House was started by 2 friends and neighbors, Joe Roger and Tom Fortner, who lived in Avondale Estates. Joe worked at Tottle House, a similar type restaurant. Tom thought they needed one in Avondale, opening the first Waffle House with the assistance of Joe's experience on Labor Day 1955, which was actually September 5th, not the 3rd. A few years later, when the Tottle House owner died, Joe came to work with Tom full-time. Waffle House pays homage to the restaurant that spawned their success on their menu.
Tottle House omelet, which is the kind of the way the omelet has been made, and I believe they made this way at the Tottle House. It's pretty much, the eggs are kind of fluffed, almost in like a whipper, like an almost like a shaker, like a milkshake kind of whip thing. So it whips the eggs like a blender. So it whips the eggs, and they're really fluffy when they, so they pour them into the pan, and they never actually like stir them or anything, and just kind of roll them around in the pan and kind of flip them. So it's a really fluffy omelet.
Though well into their 90s, Joe and Tom make appearances at the office almost daily, ensuring that the traditions they began 57 years ago are maintained.
It was very important to Joe and Tom that this was going to be the service that they wanted to provide. And even though it seems like a vast menu, it's really a lot of staple items that we do. And our grill operators are just really good at what they do, and they make these things over and over and over. So it's really not complicated for them. And it's actually fairly easy for them to do this all day long.
Good food fast, that's the goal. Of the nearly 1,650 stores nationwide, primarily in the southern regions, 75% are company-owned, the remainder franchises. All bear the familiar yellow sign. I asked Kelly about the significance behind such a bright color.
The idea of the yellow and black sign had to do with school buses, because school buses were yellow and black, and they were always very easily like noticed, and you would always see them. So the idea of having those colors to kind of mimic school buses so that they were, you know, you could see them. They were like, you couldn't miss that yellow and black signage.
Unique to not just one location, but to Waffle House as a whole, are the terms used for ordering and the terms for those famous hash brown toppings.
It's not something that we actually came up with in the office. It's kind of like our grill operators in the restaurants came up with it themselves, you know, to help them kind of, you know, remember things. Because Scattered's Mother Covered didn't debut actually until, I believe it was 1984 when it hit the menu. So before that, it wasn't called in any other way. Grill operators made up those terms to, you know, as we started adding toppings to the hash browns, a way to remember the different items. And it just kind of, you know, continued as we added new items to come up with fun ways to call them in.
And every Waffle House, if you go to in the country, you'll hear Scattered, Smothered, Covered, Chunked, all that good stuff. And all that is it's a unique language that's found only in Waffle House. It's just the way that we call in tickets. It's the way that the grill operators know what to cook.
Now that we're back at the restaurant, a salesperson. The salespeople are what you might call a server in a different restaurant. But here, they are salespeople, because they do so much more than just serving. They drop waffles, run food, wash dishes. This salesperson is calling in an order.
Pull one sausage, one ham. And then typically I need to wait for her and make sure she does it. Drop two hash browns in the ring.
See, Waffle House doesn't use a traditional ticket system. They use a pull, drop, mark system. It's the grill operator's way of remembering an order.
For example, if I'm making an order scrambled cheese, we have certain things on the plates or certain areas on the plates where we'll mark what it is. So this, for instance, would be the mark for order scrambled cheese. You put a jelly packet down there, some cheese, and this means hash browns. So this would be an order scrambled cheese plate, which means hash browns. It's just a unique language that we use here that it won't really translate too much from anywhere else except at another Waffle House.
I don't know about you, but I'm ready for breakfast. My typical Waffle House order is the All-Star Special. It's a lot of food, yet a little bit of everything. Roy let me drop my own waffle. They make the batter fresh in the store, even stirring it by hand.
What we'll do, get a little golden sweet spray. Spray that so it doesn't stick.
In addition to breakfast, Roy says they have something for everyone. His favorite is a Philly cheesesteak, though he does like the healthier options, say a chicken wrap or a salad. They have a new lettuce mix using romaine. But for National Waffle Week, a special iced cinnamon praline waffle will be hitting the griddle. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Yeah.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
Christina Thomas.
And with us is Katie Hendrickson, host of Sunday Symphony, as well as Of Note through the week. But tonight, it's Sunday Symphony.
Sunday Symphony. And there's four symphonies this time.
So can we call it Sunday Symphonies?
I guess we could. Like last week, we only had room for two because one of the... No.
You only had
one symphony,
right?
Because it was so long, over 100 minutes long. This time, there's shorter symphonies. One's only like 20 minutes long, so I could fit four together.
Is that short for a symphony?
Yeah, it's 20 minutes is about as short as I've ever seen anything. And the thing about the symphonic form and what you call a symphony, it's a very loose term.
I was about to say, what constitutes a symphony and what is not a symphony?
I mean... Mostly it has to do with the instrumentation, although that's changed a lot too, because if you look at the earlier symphonies, the modern instruments weren't around then. So like one of the symphonies I'm going to be playing is Haydn's Symphony number 88 in G major. So, and that's on with the orchestra of the 18th century. So it's all on original instruments from that era, that time period.
The 20-minute symphony that you're playing tonight.
Yes.
That is?
That's the Hovhannes one.
That's the Hovhannes, okay.
Yeah, and it's four symphonies. I'm trying to remember. It's his symphony number 53 called Star Dawn, Opus 377. But he's a 20th century composer. So it starts with Haydn, goes all the way up to the like 20th century. And then we have Tchaikovsky and Charles Ives in the middle.
Charles Ives.
His very first symphony, which he actually wrote when he was still in college. So it's kind of a, you know, he's pretty, he does a lot of things that were stretching the limits of classical music, but that was when he was still in college. So a lot of people talk about it as being a more derivative, conservative symphony because he was still learning. Mm-hmm. He was figuring things out then. So.
Will we hear them in chronological order?
The symphony, yeah, we will actually. The Tchaikovsky is pretty close to the Ives. Tchaikovsky wrote his symphony number 5 in E minor in 1888, and Ives wrote his first symphony between 1898 and 1902. But the Haydn is 1787, and Hovhannes, I didn't write down the date on, but I think it's probably, it's the latter 20th century. So,
So four symphonies tonight.
Four symphonies.
Starting at?
7 o'clock.
All right. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, guys.
This is a lunch that was made today, am I right? A meat sandwich, milk. One day a week, we serve milk.
Twice today, volunteers have gathered in a building in downtown Fort Smith to prepare and hand out sack lunches to anybody who asks.
Now, milk is expensive. It's like buying gas. And so each week, the price of the milk fluctuates, okay? So this is like gold here.
That's Gene Koljeski, one of the co-directors of the Sack Lunch program on 6th Street in downtown Fort Smith.
And they get a dessert, a sandwich, a drink, and they get fruit.
Before the year is over, more than 50,000 such lunches will have been given to people who just walk up to a door across the street from St. John's Episcopal Church. Last Thursday afternoon, Linda McDonough, Gene Koljeski, and Kim Pearson were putting meat, cheese, and mustard on bread and placing those sandwiches inside brown paper sacks. The lunches would be handed out the next day. Linda and Jean are two of the three co-directors of the program. Kim is a board member. Over the course of a month, the Sack Lunch program will have hundreds of volunteers preparing lunches in this room, then handing them out through a serving door. Jean Koljeski walks to a bulletin board in a hallway outside of this room and points to a picture of Mary Wise, a parishioner at St. John's Episcopal Church who started the program on her own, modestly, in 1986.
She would see hungry people outside the church because we have the bus station right over there, and it bothered Mary tremendously. So she started bringing Vienna sausage and crackers from home and serving the people, anybody that she saw. And as time went on, the priest from over there said, share your ministry with the church. So the church started to do this and started at St. John's, and so they supported it. It was like this little secret, and it was just St. John's who did this.
Since then, another 16 churches and organizations have become involved. Every Monday through Friday morning, free basic meals are given out for a half hour beginning at 8:30 and 11:30. Another meal is available Saturday mornings at 11:30. Kim Pearson, a board member and volunteer for the program, says in an effort to maximize resources, The lunch program only offers one meal over the weekend.
One thing that Gene is also very good at is finding other services that are available in town and not duplicating those services. And so there are a lot of churches that serve on Saturdays, and there are a lot more that serve on Sundays.
There is a fierce dedication among the directors to stretch limited assets as far as they can. The program is all volunteer. Nobody gets paid. Through grants, in-kind help, and donations, each meal costs only 63 cents to produce. Volunteers drive from Fayetteville and Oklahoma to help on their assigned days. Gene Kuljeski keeps track of all of this on an elaborate color-coded sheet in the hallway.
This is my schedule. It kind of gives you an idea. I have over 300 volunteers now who come through, and I really can't tell you how many volunteers I have because people bring their friends. Kim brings her whole homeschool group, which could be 20 kids that I don't even know about. But on my list, I have about 300 volunteers that I keep on my email list, and I send out monthly emails to. And this is how the calendar goes.
The precision of her planning is impressive. For today's date, August 28th, there is a notation that says, Bill Chandler, bananas.
Bill Chandler goes and picks up bananas from Sam's for me. Because we really feel good. We try to provide a nutritious lunch. So we serve fresh fruit with almost every meal that we serve. So he goes and he picks up 3 cases of bananas on Mondays from Sam's. If they have, and he'll first call the food bank. Because if the food bank has them, then we get them for free. If they don't have them, then we have to purchase them. So he goes to Sam's, picks up 3 cases of bananas, and brings them back. Usually he gets them here Tuesday morning so that I'll have bananas through here. Then I'm supposed to have another group right here to bring bananas to take us through to there.
Sandwiches and bananas and desserts are more needed now than any time in the SAC lunch program's history. Gene says there was a 28% increase in lunches given away between 2010 and 2011, and already this year more than 35,000 lunches have been made. She says since the economic plunge in 2008, more and more people have been showing up. On a calendar by the serving door is a somber scorecard of how much this program is in demand in Fort Smith. Each day of the month has several check marks, each one representing a lunch that was given to a child.
We never used to see kids stand in a line. It was rarity to see children. Then I started seeing more, and I thought, well, we need to keep, instead of me just saying, oh, we see a lot more kids. Well, now we track the children. And believe, you know, everybody, when they see it, they put it, or if they say that the lunch is for a child, then we put a tick mark here. So that gives us an idea of how many lunches are going for children.
And so it looks like today, the day we're talking, the 21st, there's 40 or so.
Yes. Now, in July, there was over 800, I think 890 lunches were served to children. So now here's the bread freezer over here. All right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Donated refrigerators line the wall in another room. A schedule guides volunteers to know when to transfer bread from the freezer to a fridge. And another refrigerator is the mustard. Mayo was dropped from the program to help stretch money a bit further. That sort of maneuver pays off. On days when the lunches include an orange, volunteers this year can put a whole orange in the sack instead of just half of one. The main operation here is to hand out lunches. But a line of folders along the hallway allows volunteers to help provide more information. One folder is labeled dental, another utilities. The sheets in the folders are lists of agencies that can help with each related subject. Kim Pearson says there's even a folder labeled laundry.
I love this laundry. West Ark Church of Christ, you can go once a month and they'll pay for the laundry service, like the coin-operated laundry. West Ark Church of Christ will do that. They'll also bring furniture. There's one. We need one for furniture.
11 times a week, the volunteers hand out the lunches with no forms to fill out or requirements to be met. Linda McDonough, one of the 3 co-directors, did ask people waiting in line this summer just a few questions to better track who the program is serving. 41% of respondents said they were unemployed, 12% said they're working, 17% disabled, 7% say they're homeless, 5% retired, and 18% are children. Kim Pearson says she and the other board members are constantly asking themselves how they can do better. And often, she says, difficult questions can lead to long conversations. One of those tough questions can be from a person in line asking for 2 lunches.
We've been instructed and talked about it over and over and over about just listening to your heart. What does your heart say? And the rule is that we ask them to go to the back of the line to make sure that everyone gets a sandwich before we give 2. Well, last month when I served, I think it was 110 degrees, and there was no one in the line. It was whether or not you give these two lunches. So the man came and he said, I'd like two lunches. I say, is one for a child, so we can count it. And he says, actually, they're just both for me. He says, it's just not enough. So we got to talking about the number of calories in that meal, and like, I have a 17-year-old son. That would not be, that's a snack, you know, for a 17-year-old son. So whether or not we could make the meal a few more calories in it, or whether we just go ahead and give two lunches to the big strapping guy. So we do. We just give him two lunches.
Kim says they've never run out of food. In-kind donations include all of the bread given by Mrs. Baird's Bread. Desserts are from Little Debbie's, and twice a week delivery of hot soup comes from the nearby restaurant Taliano's. St. John's Episcopal Church on North 6th donates the building space, utilities, and maintenance. There is a once-a-year Sack Lunch Sunday fundraiser, and many participating churches will sponsor an entire month. Linda McDonough says all of that reduces what should be the cost of a $1.08 per lunch to the 63 cents per lunch. And the regular volunteers, she says, make for a tight community of servers and recipients.
One time I was here, what was I doing? Maybe not making lunches, but doing something in the back, taking care of meat. And I could hear the person at the window distributing the lunches, and she was thanking them for taking the lunches. And I couldn't see, but I could hear what was going on. There's chemistry at that window, without a doubt. You know, people coming up, not to get a lunch, but to get some friendly interaction as well.
If you'd like to know more about the Sack Lunch program in Fort Smith, there is more information, including phone numbers and addresses, at our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
It's Labor Day weekend.
It is.
I put together a slight audio quiz. 9 popular culture salutes to...
Working?
Working for this Labor Day weekend. We're going to play them, see how many you can identify.
All right.
Have I got your attention now? Good. Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize, a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired.
You know, I'm aware of this management training thing you're doing tonight, and I'm worried it's going to affect your performance at work.
That's extracurricular, you know. Some people play golf.
Well, I play golf.
There you go. So,
yes, but I'm performing as I want me to perform. You're not performing as I want you to perform.
I'm performing as I want me to perform.
I don't want you to perform
like
that.
It's a good performance. Let's agree to disagree.
No, let's agree that you agree with me.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to step down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine.
Mr. Mason, no one around here is on my side. And I'm not going to leave until I set down all your names on this piece of paper.
Lady, I want you off the premises now. You phone your husband, you come over here and tell him to fetch you. I want you out of here right quick.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons. What do you get?
How does it feel to be an exec?
Oh, fine.
Sit down.
I want you to know I worked very hard to justify your confidence.
I'm sure. Say, Baxter, about the apartment. Now that you've got a raise, don't you think we can afford a second key?
Well, I guess so.
You know, my secretary, Miss Olson.
Oh, yeah, very attractive. Is she the lucky girl that...
Oh, no, I just met that she...
I have an appointment with... Emily Charlton.
Andrea Sachs.
Yes?
Great. Human resources certainly has an odd sense of humor. Follow me. Okay, so I was Miranda's second assistant, but her first assistant recently got promoted, and so now I'm the first.
Oh, and you're replacing yourself.
Well, I am trying. Miranda sacked the last two girls after only a few weeks. We need to find someone who can survive here. Do you understand?
Yeah, of course.
You appear.
apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out. Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah.
If you got them all, you spend way too much time with pop culture, I think. If you would like to know the answers, you can see them at our webpage at ozarksatlarge.com. It's the second day of September 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So here's a great music story.
All right.
Aspiring young musician, like junior high school age, his name's Gary Peel, wanted to learn to play guitar. And one of his friends went down to the local music store, and there was a guy there teaching guitar. Mm-hmm. So the friend said, let's go learn guitar from this guy. And they took lessons. And then they went to see their teacher perform with a band called The Warlocks.
Okay.
And a few months later, the band changed its name to The Grateful Dead.
Oh.
I like it.
They were learning to play from Jerry Garcia.
Well, there you go.
Gary Peel, who is performing with Boston, coming up at Downstream Casino, has had that kind of good luck his whole career. He played with all sorts of people. And then he got into Sammy Hagar's band before Van Halen. Mm-hmm. And then he got a call from Tom Schatz asking him to play with Boston. He went from the last gig with Sammy Hagar, which was a Farm Aid concert, to play with Boston in, I think, 1985, and he's been there ever since.
That's a long time.
He's had a happy career. But he does say that if you want to play music, you should listen to his dad, who made him go to college.
Mm-hmm. What was it? Do you know what his degree is in?
I don't know that he finished. Oh, okay. I know that dad took him down and made him start.
He went.
He went. Anyway, they are performing on Thursday at Downstream Casino near Joplin, and $5 from every ticket will go to Joplin relief efforts.
Great.
He's also big into that sort of thing. So showtime's 8 o'clock, gates open at 7, tickets start at $40 at downstreamcasino.com. Anyway, this afternoon, the Prairie Grove Clothesline Fair continues at Prairie Grove Battlefield State Park. Have your $5.
For your car.
For your car.
You going?
Yes.
Okay.
I like craft fairs. It's a family thing. All the women go.
Love craft fairs. I love it when it's bikes, blues, and barbecue weekend, and it's the crafts fair in Lincoln, because you see all the lady bikers buying crafts. I just love it. Anyway, there's another tour at Lake Fort Smith State Park today. It's the Summer Breeze Boat Tour. Starts at 2 o'clock. You can make reservations at 369-1018. Again, it's $9 for adults and $5 for children, 6 to 12. And there's an ice cream social this afternoon.
In Fort Smith.
From 2 to 4 at the Fort Smith Museum of History Soda Fountain. And down the street at the Fort Smith Trolley Museum, they're going to have a lawbreakers and peacemakers shootout at 3 o'clock.
All right.
Ice cream's $5. And don't forget Noises Off, the Theater Squared comedy. Really, go. Listen to Kyle, who says if you've seen the movie, you need to see the play. Forget the movie, see the play. 2 and 7 o'clock today at the Nadine Baum Studios in Fayetteville. Tickets start at $24.
After the matinee today, I'll be on stage with some of the cast and crew talking about it.
Oh, cool.
So.
Excellent. So go to that one.
All right. Thank you, Becca.
Thanks, Becca.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday, the 2nd of September, 2012. It was on this day, 1901, Theodore Roosevelt uttered his famous words, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." He was vice president, giving a speech at the Minnesota State Fair. He said, "If the American nation will speak softly and yet continue to build and keep at a pitch of the highest training a thoroughly efficient Navy, the Monroe Doctrine will go far." The Monroe Doctrine, which dated back to 1823, President Monroe warning European powers not to interfere in Latin America. The Monroe Doctrine, which took on a life of its own and became a central part of America's foreign policy. The precedent for U.S. intervention in Panama, Colombia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Cuba. Less than 2 weeks after that speech at the State Fair, President McKinley was assassinated in Buffalo, and Teddy Roosevelt found himself the youngest person ever to be president of the United States. And his big stick, diplomacy, as it came to be known, was the centerpiece of American foreign policy under his administration. On another occasion, Roosevelt said, "If a man continually blusters, if he lacks civility, a big stick will not save him from trouble, and neither will speaking softly avail if back of the softness there does not lie strength and power." It's the birthday of the founder of Cirque du Soleil, Guy Laliberté, born in Quebec City, 1959, an accordionist and stilt walker and fire eater who formed an acrobatic troupe out of a band of street buskers in 1984 with support of a grant from the provincial government of Quebec. There are now 22 different Cirque du Soleil shows, and Mr. Laliberté has a net worth estimated at $2.5 billion. And it was on this date, 1666, the Great Fire of London started, broke out near London Bridge in the house of the king's baker, Thomas Farriner. One of his workers awoke 2 a.m. to the smell of smoke. There was a strong wind. The blaze spread rapidly. It was the worst fire in the history of London, burned 4 days, destroyed 80% of the city, nearly 90 churches, including St. Paul's Cathedral. Buildings in London at the time made of timber and pitch, the streets very narrow and crowded, sometimes overhanging, upper stories nearly touched the ones across the way. But remarkably, there were only 4 reported casualties, and the fire did have the benefit of halting the progress of the plague, which had been ravaging London for several years. The rats and their fleas perished in large numbers. And within days of the fire, the architects Christopher Wren and Robert Hooke submitted their plans for rebuilding the city. The original layout of London was preserved, although the streets were widened. And Christopher Wren was given the job of rebuilding 50 of the churches, including St. Paul's Cathedral, which remains one of his masterpieces. Here's a poem for today by Tom Gunn, entitled The Night Piece. The fog drifts slowly down the hill, and as I mount, gets thicker still, closes me in, makes me its own, like bedclothes on the paving stone. Here are the last few streets to climb, galleries run through veins of time, almost familiar, where I creep toward sleep like fog, through fog like sleep. The Night Piece by Tom Gunn, from his collected poems published by the Noonday Press, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world. You can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Joy Biles, engineered by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, featuring commercial building projects, contractors, and subcontractors, plus local business news in Northwest Arkansas. The current edition is available by calling 725-0394 or visit nwabusinessjournal.com to register for daily business e-news.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Natural Dam. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellens.
I'm Christina Thomas.
I'll be back tomorrow with a brand new edition for Labor Day. You and I will be back together, I think,
Thursday.
All right.
Happy Sunday.